Hello and welcome to this Bowel Cancer UK videocast. A first for me, by the way. We're the UK's leading bowel cancer charity, determined to save lives and improve the quality of life of everyone affected by bowel cancer. We fund targeted research, provide expert information and support to patients and their families, educate the public and professionals about the disease, and campaign for early diagnosis and access to best treatment and care. Now, I'm George Alagaya. I'm a BBC journalist, but I also happen to be living with stage four bowel cancer. Joining me today for this videocast from various parts of the UK are Beth Purvis, who was diagnosed with bowel cancer in 2016. Let's see you put your hand up, Beth. There she is. And we've also got Richard Adams, who is Professor and Honorary Consultant Clinical Oncologist at Cardiff University. And the Velen, I didn't get this right. I just asked him the pronunciation and I'm going to mess it up.
I can do that bit.
You can do that bit when it's like the Velindra Cancer Centre and a member of Bowel Cancer UK's Medical Advisory Board. And finally, we've got Genevieve Edwards, who is a Chief Executive at Bowel Cancer UK. Now, we're going to try and talk about a whole range of things, including life in lockdown and life coming out of lockdown, and the recovery of cancer services, as I say, as we begin to emerge from these last 3 months. Thank you all for being here today. Beth, let me start with you. And I know you've said already that you're happy to talk about your personal experience. So thank you for that. But just bring us up to date. Tell us about your diagnosis and where you are now.
Yeah, I was diagnosed in 2016 at the age of 37. I was misdiagnosed with IBS to start with.
IBS being?
Just irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah.
So I then ended up in hospital, diagnosed stage 3, quickly developed to stage 4. Tumours were found in my lungs. I've had various chemotherapy, various surgeries. And I was due to have further surgery on my lungs to remove a tumour that had come back after 14 months clear. And then that got cancelled due to COVID. But I was really lucky that we were able to do some alternative treatment. However, there was a delay in starting that. And while I was having some radiotherapy to my lungs, instead of the operation, which should have the same effect as the operation, I just started having headaches. So I had to then go to hospital. It was the recent bank holiday weekend a few weeks back. And they did a scan of my head and discovered that it's now spread to my brain. And I've just completed a course of whole brain radiotherapy. And I'm waiting to see if I can have more targeted radiotherapy.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I just want to stay with you for a little bit longer, Beth. But Richard, just let's get some details here. Beth was talking about stage 4. Just in case there are people listening and watching this, just tell us what stage 4 actually means.
Okay, so the staging of a cancer helps us really group different patients together and allows us to look at plans for their management. And to inform patients as to what likely outcomes of that management is as well. So it gives a sort of risk assessment, essentially. Most cancers are sort of linked in that way. We move generally from stage 1 to stage 4, with stage 4 being more advanced disease. And in bowel cancer, stage 4 generally alludes to the fact that somebody has got metastases. So that means essentially that the tumour has moved beyond the bowel wall and maybe the local lymph nodes and has spread to other parts of the body. And the common places in bowel cancer, which are different to other cancers because cancers are different. So the commonest places are the liver and the lungs, but it can also, as Beth indicates, affect bones and brain and other parts of the body as well.
Thank you for that. And Jen, in your experience at Bowel Cancer UK, I mean, here's a young woman, 37. How uncommon is that?
Well, most people are diagnosed with bowel cancer over the age of 60, the great majority of people. But there is a small but significant number of people who are younger who develop bowel cancer. And that's we've seen that increase slightly as well, which is very worrying. And the trouble is, as Beth talks about, because it's rarer in younger people, it can take younger people longer to get diagnosed. Quite often misdiagnosed, we often hear about people going to their GPs multiple times before they get a bowel cancer diagnosis. And as a result of that, younger people quite often find that they're diagnosed with more advanced stages. So we are really concerned about that. And we've been doing some work, some research with younger bowel cancer patients to find out how we can improve that diagnosis. And actually working with Beth on something like a symptom tracker to help people be really specific with their GPs about what they're experiencing.
Beth, I wonder if you could shed some light on this. So you are one of these young people, you know, and you go to a GP, and we're not asking you to kind of point fingers or blame at anyone. But did you get that sense of because you were young, cancer was kind of the last thing you're thinking about?
Absolutely. And actually, the GP said that wouldn't really worry about cancer somebody of your age. And she suggested that it was possibly IBS. She wasn't very, she was a little bit dismissive. And I think that is partly because of their training. At the moment, they still view it as an older person cancer. And I don't think it's an individual's fault. I think because we're in a changing situation where there's now an increase in younger people, that actually things need to change in terms of their training and understanding. So that's something that, you know, hopefully I can help with in terms of the symptoms tracker that we've developed, which I've worked really closely with Bowel Cancer UK, because that's added my story to that. So it right. can really open their eyes up to GPs that actually, oh, okay, there's somebody who was quite young who's developed this. Maybe we should look at that. But that's not to say that every young person that comes in with those symptoms is going to have bowel cancer, because most yeah. of them won't. And the GP will be able to reassure them. But I think the symptoms tracker is a great idea, that because when I went, I was asked questions like, how long has it been going on for? Well, I was a busy mum working. I couldn't remember.
You just said there, you're a busy mum, Beth. And I wonder, and at any point, by the way, if there's things you don't want to talk about, just say so. But could you, I mean, those of us living with cancer know that it affects our families, you know, almost as much as ourselves. In some ways, I've felt, you know, through my 6+ years of living with cancer, that sometimes I have the easy part, actually. And certainly once a diagnosis happens and I've got great kind of doctors around like Richard, and they kind of take care of you. And so my job is kind of just to stay fit, and it's my family who've got to watch all the other things. Talk to me a little bit about how you shared it with your family, and especially your children are quite young, I imagine.
Yeah, my children are, they're 10 and 12 now, but obviously this was 4 years ago that I was diagnosed. We were just very open and honest with them, using age-appropriate language. And we drip-fed the information as we got it, because I think with children, you can't give them too much at once to absorb. And you've got to give them the opportunity to think about it and talk about it. But I didn't want to lie to them or try and hide it from them. And I think because I was very aware that it couldn't shorten my life, and I don't want them to be angry with me that they haven't had the opportunity to talk about it with me, or that I've lied to them, or there's no trust there. And then who can they trust that's left behind? Jen, and I think
sorry to interrupt. Jen, I saw you nodding away when Beth was talking about talking to the children.
Yes, very much so. I've got young children myself, and I was just listening to Beth, and absolutely it was resonating with me in terms of when you've got big things to talk to children about, finding the way of doing it that doesn't frighten them, but they can absorb. So yes, I was absolutely nodding.
Okay. And Richard, as a clinician, do you think enough of your, what do I call them, your tribe, if I can call them that. I mean, do you think enough of them now understand that this is a disease that affects not just the patient, the family, and you know, involve the family in both the diagnosis and talking about treatment and the effects of the treatment?
I think increasingly so. I think it is a critical part of the training to some degree of student doctors. And I think we were poor at it a number of years ago. I think this has been an iterative process in improving that. Certainly locally in Cardiff, and I know this happens more broadly across the UK, we take medical students through a thing specifically called the Oncology Project, where we ask for patients individually and their families if we can allocate a student to follow them up through their cancer pathway for a period of 4 months as on a sort of one-to-one level. And a lot of that project is about not the technical bits of how to do medicine. It's about how the interactions between the healthcare profession, how the interactions within a family are so critically important, because it is so important as clinicians that we actually do understand that, because it impacts upon decision-making processes. It impacts upon discussions that we have. It impacts upon advice that we give. And Beth, obviously, taking that, you know, with hopefully the support and advice, that very appropriate approach to how to discuss with children, to discuss with other members of the family. And it has to be tailored to the individual. But there are some core principles which, through experience and knowledge, working with other specialist psychologists, child psychologists, etc., palliative care teams, that actually we've been able to establish what we consider the best advice. And research is ongoing. So, you know,
great.
Not just research about new drugs, it's about research about optimum care of living with and beyond cancer.
Beth, thank you very much for sharing your story, if I can put it that way. Let's move on now. Let's assume Beth wasn't diagnosed sort of 4 years ago, but it was kind of now. Richard, what's been happening to cancer services in the last 3-4 months? If you could, not just talk about the Welsh experience, but what you know of the UK in general.
Yeah, no, certainly. And I think it's evidently it's been a huge time of upheaval and challenges and difficulties. And I think certainly, again, very much there's been a learning curve and things have changed rapidly. And I think there's some degree frustrations around that. We weren't optimally doing things at the beginning. And some degrees, I think, we should be rewarded for by, you know, looking at changes, adapting, trying to optimize things as go forward. So there's significant things we've learned. I think when the pandemic first really reached the UK and we understood that there were going to be significant implications in the healthcare system, there was a huge amount of preparatory work which was required. But that did result in a lot of things stopping, and Beth alluded to that. And it was a lot of it's because of uncertainty. It's like many things in this world, that if the less information we have, the more fear we have around things. And healthcare is exactly the same. And even within a huge organization that is the NHS, then the same phenomenon occur. So we were learning. We were trying to gain as much information from our international collaborators, Italy, obviously China, as we could. We were having teleconferences with them to, you know, get updates from them so we could get advice. But actually, it was a case of a lot of it shutting down things. Cancer care is a team structure. Obviously, patient very much at the center of that. But we look at the healthcare system, you know, specialities and the individuals within the NHS that work to deliver a treatment pathway for an individual is a huge undertaking. And it affected different bits of that pathway in different ways. I think certainly I'm sort of more towards the end of the scale. I treat with chemotherapy, radiotherapy, etc. So by the time somebody comes to me, they're well onto that pathway. You know, got the diagnosis, etc. They've got their stage and we can make a plan. And then the patient under my care, the individual, I know them over a considerable length of time. And we are on a treatment pathway. It's not a one-stop shop, as you both will know. Whereas actually some elements around surgery, for instance, may be delivered at you know, two or three time points. You may have the meetings, the diagnosis, planned operation undertaken, and then recovery. And then you're either passed on to the oncologist or you move into a follow-up. pathway. So there's single points where maybe the higher risk was identified of having surgery, and obviously the risk of having COVID-19 at the time considered huge and significant risks. And we weren't.
And that's where there were some blockages, is it?
There were. And I think that it was all about fear of doing more harm than good.
Okay. I want to just, if I can interrupt you there, Richard. So that's a situation clinically. I mean, you know, wanting to do, not to do harm. And so it's holding back on some services. I know Bowel Cancer UK has actually looked into this and come up with some figures, and I want to discuss them in a moment. But Jen, given what was going on in the NHS, it would have felt to you as a leading bowel cancer charity to kind of step in and help guide people, I presume, through this process. So what was it like for you?
One of the things that we were really keen to do was to get on top of all the different guidance very quickly. It was coming out quite rapidly. And of course, health in the UK is a devolved issue. So we started seeing slightly different guidance coming out in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and England. And so it was really important for us that we were able to communicate that quickly and clearly to people with bowel cancer. So we've got a new coronavirus hub on our website with all of that information on it. And 40,000 people have visited that information and I hope found it helpful. But we've also tried to find other ways of getting information out to people and really think about what people's needs are now. Because George, I would imagine you and Beth too, you've been shielding for the last several weeks. And so
I probably should have been, but that's another story actually. My letter came after I'd got COVID. Whether I'm meant to be shielding or not. I mean, I ended up not shielding actually because, well, I never got the letter. This is good. So we've got a picture there, Beth, from Richard and Jen about, you know, how they've had to deal with the lockdown. Just, and you alluded to this before, but just could you say again, in the last 3 months, what, in practical terms, what difference a lockdown made to you, whether there were particular appointments or something that were missed? I mean, just remind us again.
Yeah, so I had my surgery cancelled, which, I mean, that was devastating, but I understood the reasons because, okay, the cancellation of surgery, the delay could shorten my life, but if I got COVID following a surgical procedure to my lungs, that could shorten my life even more. So I think that was an understandable clinical decision when you're dealing with a new virus that appears to attack the lungs.
Just very quickly, could you just say how that was, did you feel that was explained to you in a way in which you could understand and accept? I mean, you clearly have accepted and thought it was a good decision, but you were happy with all of that, were you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm treated at the Royal Marsden and my lungs would have been treated at the Royal Brompton. And they're very, very good. I can email my consultants and have conversations with them over the phone. So that was certainly explained to me, and I totally understood that. I was very lucky to then have my team look at alternative options, and radiotherapy appeared to be a safer option, although, of course, there would be a delay in giving the treatment. But so we went ahead with that. But all my appointments have been by telephone outside of actual treatment. And actually, I have found that really useful. I think...
Sorry to interrupt. Useful or better? Better. I mean, useful or better?
Better. Sitting around a sitting room. I can have a discussion with them on the phone, and if the appointment's late, the appointment's late. It doesn't matter where I am. They call my mobile. I know I'm expecting a call, and that's much easier for me.
Okay.
I think I'm so far down the line as well that I don't feel the need to have a face-to-face conversation all the time, and I don't necessarily need the level of support that somebody needs at the beginning of their cancer journey.
We've had Beth's individual experience, and of course you at Bowel Cancer UK have had to try and extrapolate that, to look at it on a national level. And I was just saying that your research has been looking, this is England, figures for England, but we imagine the same sort of thing is going on in the other nations of the UK. But the number of bowel cancer screening invitations not sent out in England is over the million mark. And there's some quite staggering when you break it down. Additionally, more than 4,000 people will have polyps undetected. These are kind of precancerous things you can find in the gut. 8,500 people who had already received a pre-lockdown positive screening result in England are still waiting for further diagnostic colonoscopy investigations. So firstly, Jen, if you could explain, I've given those figures. I mean, what does that mean, actually? You know, we're not just talking numbers. These are, each one of those is a person.
Exactly. I'm deeply concerned about this. I understand why screening and diagnostics were paused. Of course I do. You know, the NHS was facing an unprecedented challenge with COVID. But we're now in the eye of a perfect storm, really. And as Richard was saying, every aspect of the bowel cancer pathway has been disrupted. So we've got, you know, 1,300 people now with undetected bowel cancer. We've got people who haven't gone to their GP with symptoms. Those figures are about 55% of what you would normally expect to see. So I'm talking to colleagues clinicians who are saying they're very, very worried about what's going to happen in the autumn. They're bracing themselves for a lot of people coming into A&E and being diagnosed with later stage cancers. And so this is really, really worrying. And I think as screening gets up and running again, the pressure on those diagnostic services is going to increase. And to give you an idea of the challenge they're facing, it's different to many of the other cancers because that diagnostic is itself a risk of COVID transmission. And so the people who are doing...
It's an aerosol
generating procedure. And so you have to...
Oh, which bit of it? I don't remember any of mine being aerolizing or whatever the word is. Which bit of it is...
I'd probably add to that one.
Go on, Richard. Yeah, I don't remember any.
So a number of the procedures we do, lots of things we've been learning, I suppose, as we go through COVID, but there is COVID virus, for instance, in a proportion of patients' feces, for instance. So if you do a colonoscopy or insufflation of air, so pumping air into the bowel, which is what we do when we're doing either certain types of CT or colonoscopy, and then release that air, well, that in theory contaminates the air in that facility.
Obviously,
the individual, but also the whole environment. So you then think, well, I've now got to get the next patient in. What's the impact on the next patient? I've got to clean everything down first. So everything takes a lot longer, not only in terms of personal protection, but protection of the patients coming through as well.
Mm. Okay, sorry, Jen.
So we've got a fraction of the capacity that we're going to need to catch up on the backlog, because instead of seeing, you know, 8 or 10 people for colonoscopy a day, clinics are now doing perhaps 2 or 3. So it's going to have a knock-on impact for some time to come. And that's without any second wave that may or may not appear.
So let's stop it there. So that's a pretty bleak picture that Jen has painted there, Richard. What are people like you doing? I mean, you're in Wales, but you must be aware of what's going on elsewhere. I mean, what are you doing to prepare for this?
Yeah, no, I think it's been a huge challenge and lots of dialogue. And there are subtly different solutions in the different devolved nations, England versus Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. But there are good conversations going on between the different groups. And so there's relative parallels. A lot of it is about trying to put resources in the right places, increase efficiency as much as possible. We have limitations. You know, we were, again, not to point fingers, but poorly resourced before this started. You know, we were struggling to deliver the amount of investigations that we already had within the timeframes that we have set as a decent standard. And this is going to have a huge impact on that. We're looking at adapting pathways. So can we use the other parts of the screening program to adapt the numbers of patients to come through? So the FIT test, which is the thing that's been rolling out across the UK, how we try and detect early signs of bowel cancer, whether we use more CT-based examinations where colonoscopy is more limited, which is another way of trying to diagnose bowel cancers after you've had a positive screening test. So we're trying to use the various bits of the pathway and the skill mix that is across the NHS to try and optimize that. But we have a limited workforce. There's only a certain amount of people.
All right, sound like I'm putting you on the spot and making you responsible for the whole of the NHS everywhere. But can you say, if Beth or myself were now at the beginning of the process of diagnosis, can you guarantee that we would be treated the same now, 4 years and 6 years?
I have to say, we are having to adapt. We're very much trying to get back up to speed with that. And certain patients will go through the pathway in a relatively, quote, normal, if you like, the new normal fashion. So certainly I'm seeing patients come through who, you know, probably would have presented in a very similar way. But a large proportion of what we see are not. Jen alluded to earlier, I mean, actually, at my end of the scale, the number of patients that come through from screening colonoscopy that end up at my end of the scale is relatively small. But that's good, because the whole idea is to catch the tumours early. And therefore, they never need to come and see me. And the less they come and see me, the better, really. But actually, what we're seeing is the major part of the pathway that comes to me is what's called the urgent suspected cancer pathway. And those are patients with symptoms, not just a FIT test or an FOB test that's positive, but they've got true symptoms that are worrying. And they end up more likely to have more advanced disease. And it dipped, and at the lowest point, certainly, if we look across the UK, there are differences. But generally, we're down to about 30% of our normal level of referrals, which means they're not coming through. And we're now, the latest figure that I looked at regionally, because in fact, good thing about this is better intelligence. Something right. We've asked for is, you know, give us up-to-date intelligence. Tell us what's happening this week, next week. What's coming down the pathway that will, in fact impact my practice, for instance. And the urgent suspected cancers local regionally to me in Wales are now surpassing the levels that they were, if you look at a comparative last year at this time. So we're on a trajectory which is like this. So, you know, that's gonna continue to go up. So we're gonna have a mini tsunami here of things coming through a system that was stretched already. So to put my hand on my heart and say, yes, we're gonna deliver this service exactly as we've been able to over the last 3-4 years would be unfair and untrue to put that out publicly.
So Jen, that makes your life as the boss at the leading bowel cancer charity a very difficult one, because, you know, we've heard Richard talk about what's likely to happen. It falls to a charity to campaign around these things, to improve facilities. And yet I imagine, like lots of charities, you're in a pretty tough place at the moment.
Yes, that's right. We have seen our income go off a cliff. As a result of the coronavirus. And we were a small charity to start with, but we think that up to 50% of our income will disappear this year. And the reason for that is because we rely 100% on donations from the public. And a lot of those donations come from people running marathons and all those other mass participation events that people love and community fundraising that just can't happen now and is unlikely to be happening really anytime soon. So we're facing a double challenge, really. One is how we pivot what we're doing so that we're meeting the needs of people affected by bowel cancer today, because they were very different than what they were at the start of the year. And at the same time, look at how we reshape our organisation so that we can continue to have impact. But many charities won't survive. And that was, you know, I started at Bowel Cancer UK in February, and forefront of my mind is that many charities will not survive this. And if we're not here advocating for people with bowel cancer and making sure that their voices are heard around those tables where those decisions are being made about resources that the NHS needs, it's unthinkable. So we're doing everything we can to make sure that we not only continue to survive, but we can thrive and absolutely meet those changing needs, be the champion of people with bowel cancer at a time when I think, you know, it's never been more needed. I heard NHS England talking about the cancer backlog and where it's going to hit hardest. And they said it will be bowel cancer. And so it's really clear we've all got, and this is a job we'll all do together. We'll do it together. There's a very strong bowel cancer community. The clinicians are, as you've heard from Richard, very clear-sighted about what we need to do to recover. And it's our job to support that and to play our part. And I'm absolutely convinced we'll do it. It's tough, though. It's really tough.
Beth, how does it, as a patient, as someone living with cancer, how does that make you feel?
It's really worrying because, I mean, since my diagnosis, I've wanted to raise awareness to help other people not to end up in my shoes. I've spent a lot of time and effort trying to let people know that younger people can get it too, the symptoms tracker for all ages. And that's really worrying that through no fault of anybody's, just through this pandemic, that we're actually going to experience a worse situation. So we may have the awareness and people may know they need to get checked out, but they simply can't.
Richard, we're sort of running out of time. We've got a few minutes left, but I don't want to leave it, on this kind of note of, oh my God, it all looks terrible. So I know clinicians like you are thinking very hard about this. You know better than most what's at stake. So let's try and move to solutions as we all as a country, cancer patients and the rest of us, come out of this lockdown. Let's try and outline some of the solutions that you've got.
Yeah, I mean, I think it take you through that pathway, and I think it is, it's like British cycling, isn't it? If you can improve all the various little elements, it actually makes a big difference to the whole picture. So I think the first thing really is about improving confidence of the public as much as we can that the healthcare system is there. I think getting, and Beth alludes to this, getting people to present to their GPs, getting them to feel they can present safely is critically important. And I think some of the initiatives to try and open the lockdown, move slightly on from the stay at home to the, be protected, be cautious, but health is really important and present. I think that's good. I think some of the techniques and new technologies we're beginning to look at around screening and diagnostic programs are critically important. I think lots of excellent work has been undertaken in trying to deliver safe surgery, create relatively green zones, we call them, or safe zones where relatively COVID-free, so that we can actually talk to the patient about a safe environment in which their surgery can be undertaken. And they are appearing all over the UK and subtly different structures of how that work, but they're proving effective. They're slower, but they're effective. And then I think at my end of the scale, chemotherapy and radiotherapy, we're very much getting back to as much possible work as normal. We learned a lot more about the impact of COVID and chemotherapy. Initially, very, very significant fears around it. Less so now. There are increased concerns with COVID and chemotherapy, but we're in a better position to manage it. Patients with experience such as yourselves, who maybe haven't had COVID, that sort of isolation component does become important when you're on a chemotherapy agent, etc. But the advice that's being given is now much more consistent. And I think by consistency, we can create that greater safety feeling and environment in order to continue to deliver what can be excellent cancer care and will continue to be, as people are very dedicated to continue to deliver.
Great. This. And let me have Jen, a last word from you, looking forward to the weeks and months out of lockdown.
Well, I think, as both Richard and Beth have said, there are some good things that have come out of this that we probably wouldn't want to see going back to the old ways. So Beth is talking about telephone appointments, always being in the too difficult box for the NHS. And now we can do phone and video appointments where appropriate. So that's a great step forward. And I think the way that my charity has innovated, but the NHS has innovated as well, to protect as much as possible vital cancer services has been really inspirational. So I do see going forward a huge challenge ahead of us. We are going to have to make sure that the NHS has the resources it needs to get this going again. But I think if we know what we need to do, we have a clear plan and we can follow it, we will get there. But as I said before, I think it's all of us.
All right. Well, we are going to have to wrap it up. But I can tell you from Beth and me, people living with cancer, we're going to carry on demanding of you the very best that you can give, because we think we deserve it, don't we, Beth?
We certainly do.
All right. Well, Beth, Richard and Jen, thank you all for being with me today. Beth in particular, I know it's not always easy to talk about these things, but you've chosen to go public, to use your experience to help others. And I'm really grateful for that. So thank you all very much for joining me. We've covered, I think you'll all agree, quite a lot of ground. And I hope that is interesting and useful to people who watch this as we as a country come out of the lockdown. Now, if you've been affected by any of these issues that we've been talking about, you can obviously go to the Bowel Cancer UK website, and that's bowelcanceruk.org.uk. So from me, George Alagaya, thank you very much for being with us, and I hope you found it useful. Hello again, it's me, George Alagaya, and we've just finished recording our latest video cast on how people living with cancer, bowel cancer in particular, come out of a lockdown. And of course, there's always one thing you forgot to really talk about, and what we want, and that thing is the whole business of shielding and how you come out of shielding, the anxieties people have. So we just thought it's worth having a quick chat with Beth Purvis, Richard and Jen here again. So Jen, let me come to you. Yeah, you were talking about some of these issues around shielding.
Yes, so many people with bowel cancer who are going through active treatment will have been had a letter advising them to shield. And so for the last several weeks, a lot of people have been taking great care. They've been at home. They haven't had face-to-face contact with other people. And we've seen lockdown beginning to ease, and we've now learned that shielding is likely to come to an end at the end of July. Now, this has always been guidance. It's not mandatory. It's been advice that you can follow, choose to follow or not. And people have interpreted it in different ways. But I'm hearing a lot from people with bowel cancer who are quite worried about what the end of shielding means for them, particularly if you are told you can now go back to work, you can't work from home. People feeling that tension of being forced to choose between their jobs and their health. So I think there's quite a lot for us to think about, and you know, people making decisions about what's right for them and their lives.
But who should they go to for advice then if they are in that position where they feel conflicted about what to do? I mean, they can obviously come to Bowel Cancer UK. Richard, should they be phoning their consultants, their doctors, their GPs?
So I suppose it's a mixture of things. I mean, there are certainly, we will try and give advice that's as tailored as possible to the individuals. And certainly when we know somebody, that certainly helps. I think there are core principles. It's advice, so, you know, you can adapt that advice. I think there are principles, and Jen alludes to it, in terms of employment and how that is impacted. So I think close liaison with your employer. Many are being very understanding and looking at ways to allow people to deliver components of their work whilst continuing to shield, particularly when there are, you know, very good circumstances, such as an individual undergoing a treatment, a cancer treatment especially. So it is a sort of a mixture of the whole pathway. There are components, and Beth, I'm sure we'll talk to that in terms of, you know, how long one has got to live and what the impact of shielding has on one's life and what decisions one makes around that. So the advice we can give is very medical, but there are very personal components to shielding as well.
Well, how about that, Beth? I mean, so, you know, have you thought your way around this?
Yeah, I've been shielding as much as possible, but now it looks like my life expectancy is much shorter. I don't want to be stuck at home without seeing anybody. There's no point in me being alive if I can't live. So I'm now starting to think about how I can safely see my family and friends. I'm not going to go to the supermarket, that would be ridiculous. But I could have my friends to my garden and stay 2 meters apart. So that I'm starting to think I'm going to do that because I don't want to miss out on seeing people in the last months of my life. Work, I'm not so sure that I would be going to work. That would be too far in terms of risk for me. I think we've got to start to think about what level of risk we're happy to take, what our individual circumstances are. And this isn't going away, even though shielding's ending. And you've got to make a decision as to what you personally feel comfortable with.
Well, Beth, thank you very much for that, actually. I mean, and how bravely you're dealing with all of this. And I always think, you know, that there are as many ways of dealing with cancer as there are people with cancer. Each of us kind of deals with it in a different way. So on this question of shielding, which we've come back to just now, very important question, there is the medical advice. There's advice you can get from Bowel Cancer UK, but in the end, as Beth has so powerfully talked about just now, each individual is going to have to make up their mind. But I, just before we close for a second time, I would say, though, and I'm sure Beth would agree, that I think before making decisions about how we deal with coming out of shielding, which we all might be advised to in a few weeks, demand and not feel shy of asking the advice from the experts, people like Richard, the doctors, the GPs, and so on, and indeed Bowel Cancer UK is there as a resource. So for the second time, I'm going to thank you all for being with us, and I'm glad we got back to that question of shielding. Thank you very much.